Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This program is made possible thanks to the generosity of our listeners. Show your support at heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
Hi, everyone. This is Yorm dropping in to reshare the conversation I had with the Gingin brothers, whose incredible story was featured in Humans of New York this week. A new season of Item 13 kicks off next week on February 1, and I look forward to sharing more stories of resilient and inspiring African food entrepreneurs. In the meantime, here's the story of Mo and Raheem from episodes 46 and 47. Enjoy. You're listening to Item 13, an African food podcast, and I'm your host, Yorm Akuaku. Every week, we'll delve into the delicious world of African food, including chefs, curators, and bloggers. Here's the show.
So welcome to the show, Raheem. It's great to have you on. As I mentioned to you earlier, you are the final and therefore the most special guest of this
season. I feel special already.
of this season. I'm really thrilled to talk to you and, you know, share your story and your journey with the rest of the world. I'm sure a lot of people in New York and then just based on the press you've done know your story, but I think it would be helpful for the wider audience. We have a huge audience on the continent, and then just from people across the country in the US and in Canada, I think would benefit from learning from your story, which I've always found fascinating. So
Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah, cool. So for those that don't know you, what do you want to share about who you are? And you can tell us about your brother too, because he's not here to speak for himself. So you can say,
I know, right? I'll introduce him very briefly, but I don't think I will do justice to him introducing himself, so I'll announce him, but I won't go into any detail, you know. He's my brother, we're very, very close, but still, everyone's, you know, likes to present themselves in a very specific way, and I don't want to violate that, you know.
Right.
But yeah, thank you. Thank you so much for having us on here. When I heard you were doing this podcast, I was very excited about it. And specifically, an African food podcast, I always felt like the media component in African food and beverages, going into the mainstream was lacking, right? And so when I stumbled upon this, when I got your email, which I was very, very late to reply to, I just loved the whole idea, and the context within which we met back in the Dining on the Mat series, I just loved the production level of that event that I felt like you would I look good talking to you on any platform, you know. So thank you for having me.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, so I'm the co-founder of Gingin Brothers. My brother is the other half, my brother Mohammed, and really our goal with Gingin Brothers is to develop and bring to market food and beverage products inspired by traditional African recipes. And you know, we started out with Jinjang, a classic ginger-based beverage that you find throughout West Africa, made with fresh ginger, pineapples, lemon, vanilla, and anise. But really, our goal is not to stop there, right? It's to take everything from, other beverages like Jinjang and other snacks and, you know, traditional grains and dishes and stews, all these things that we of the continent know are there and are amazing. And if the rest of the world was to get a chance to get exposed to it, they would absolutely embrace it. and really bring it to market in a way that would do justice to the people and the culture within which these products evolved. So that's the overall mission.
Yeah, you summarized it quite nicely, and there's a lot to unpack in that summary that we will cover throughout our conversation today. But I wanted to take us maybe, I don't know how many years back that would be, but just how and when did you guys end up in the States? Because a lot of African immigrants that I speak to have, you know, their own interest, including myself, have their own interesting ways of, one, how they ended up here. Two, they probably started in a quote-unquote traditional job or role, and then sort of found themselves in this food space, not just for the business aspect of it, but there's also like that, you know, story to you, that authentic storytelling piece, you know, like wanting to share aspects of ourselves. So if we go back, you tell me how many years ago, I don't know how many years ago that was, but how you landed here. And then even as you spoke about, you know what you want to do with Gingin in terms of not just the drink, but eventually snacks and whatnot, it made me think about the fact that you guys are guys, right? And when I think about how I grew up cooking very early on, and I think of my younger brother now who was not immersed as much in the kitchen as my sister and I were, right? So I also wonder what that connection is for you in terms of kitchen experience and then coming into this.
Sure. So I'll touch on when we got here first, and then maybe go right, and then go back to the somewhat beginning and tie in how the, like you said, males in Africa traditionally you don't really catch them much in the kitchen unless they're hungry, you know?
Right.
and I was hungry a lot, so maybe that has something to do with it. my brother came to the States before I did. He came in 97. He was 13, going on 14 years old. He stayed with friends of the family. I mean, like you said, our immigrant story, that if you were to like unpack that portion of it, we'll spend a whole hour only talking about that. So I'm only going to brush
away. Yeah, it's fine. I think because you guys do a lot of press, I can link up to some, for people that want to know the whole story, I can link to some other press that shares it, because ultimately I want to touch on it so people have a sense or a flavor of it, but what our goal for the conversation ultimately is to help, one, because we have a lot of small food business owners that listen to this, so want to delve more into your operations versus
exactly. It's a podcast about food, specifically African food, so that's what we're going to spend a bulk of the time talking about. My brother came in 97, around 13. He stayed with friends of the family in Pennsylvania and then moved down to Atlanta with another friend of the family. Ended up coming back to New York briefly and graduated high school in New Hampshire. So I came to see his graduation. I came in 2001, around 2001. I was 14, about a month or so before I turned 15. And initially I was just coming on vacation. And the plan was for me to stay for the summer, go back home, finish high school there, and I probably would have ended up in France for college or Canada or something like that. But I ended up staying because after the summer I was learning English, and we just figured that it's a good idea for me to stay here. And since I was somewhat young and learned the culture and just have an easier time as I grow older adapting to the American culture and Western culture as a whole. So that's sort of how we got here. Academically, fast forward a few years later, my brother went to business, he studied business in undergrad. I don't want to say he went to business school and people think an MBA. He did business administration in undergrad, and I did engineering for undergrad and grad school. I Yeah, well, I did engineering undergrad at Michigan State grad school in Germany and France. And my brother did his undergrad. He started out at Polytech, NYU Polytech here, and finished up at Mercy. And the way we got into this food business, really, our goal early on, and this is something that any African that's been here any length of time would attest to, it's really just a general frustration of how we present it to the world, right? For one, if we present it at all, right? So it's just starting something that would allow us to present Africa in a better light. So we could have done this in fashion, in music, media, we just happened to do it in food, and for a number of reasons. Food is one of the principal aspects of any culture, right, that can be readily embraced by someone else with minimal effort. You know, unlike traveling or learning a new language, right, you can walk into a Ghanaian restaurant, a South African restaurant, without having ever, interacted with that culture before, right? Taste their food, learn their food, and really, if you fall in love with that, it opens up your curiosity to learn the culture further, right? So that's sort of why we picked food. And beyond that, if you think about the situation of traditional African foods in Africa, it's a massive market that's extremely fragmented, and there's yet to be really any significant brand behind that, right? You have an easier time getting, cases of name the imported brand or product than you do having some of the local stuff, which is mind-boggling.
And even in the fragmented market, I'm finding that, like, Chinese and Asian stores are also sort of taking hold, like, in terms of groceries or retail in some ways. Yep. They're taking over that space as well, which is frustrating.
You're right. Before them, it's the Lebanese, and in Western in Francophone countries, the French. If it's something more valuable, if in the Anglophone countries, maybe some of the Brits and something like that. But that's it. It's almost never us, commercializing our own stuff. So we feel like the African market, like the traditional beverage space in Africa, or not just beverage, food, beverage, like everything, CPG. Is so massive, right? And that if we build a brand here, and the only reason we started in the US is because one, we're in the US, and two, infrastructurally, it's easier to launch a business here than it is to launch a business in Africa, right? And we also felt that if we start a business here, we build it, we're of the continent, we understand the culture really well. If we take it from here, and then we go back to Africa, there'll be a sense of pride in our people in receiving it. And let's be honest, oftentimes the people, the businesses that are started on the continent by people of the continent aren't as readily embraced, right?
Right. But until they quote unquote make it elsewhere, which is
So, but if you bring your brand back there, and it's like, hey, this is killing it in America or in France or in name the Western country, right? And you have. White people are drinking this, or white people are eating this. All of a sudden, they'll embrace you a little more readily. I mean, that is not the primary reason, but these are all factors that played into us deciding, let's get this going here before anything else. As for spending any time in the kitchen or why we started the food product not being cooks, for one thing, so we came here at a really relatively young age. So in some ways, we had to be independent. I mean, at least me, my brother is not a great cook, but I cook a lot, right? Because by the time I got to college, even when I was in high school, I used to cook for us at home. And when I was a kid back home in Guinea, I was a little fat kid. So I loved hanging out with my mom in the kitchen, right? Because I'd be in the kitchen, I would help her cut the meat or do something like that, just so I have first dibs when the food is ready. You know what I mean? And I just generally loved hanging out with my mom. Mm. So there was that exposure. This doesn't mean that I knew how to cook whatsoever. but, you know, I had an affinity for, you know, I didn't grow up with this mindset and of men don't spend time in the kitchen. And my dad also wasn't like that. My dad was pretty progressive in that sense. Mm. So all of that played into it. Cool. Plus, here I spent about, you know, I essentially paid my way through college waiting tables in the U.S.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I waited tables, I attended bar, I managed a bar, so I have a lot of experience in the hospitality space. Everything from little mom and pop shops to like Michelin star restaurants in New York City.
Cool. So actually, even before we go ahead, I think it might be helpful to explain what ginger means. Like, I don't know if it has any specific meaning in a language. It sounds like ginger. So I don't know if it's a play on the word ginger or if it's, I don't know. You tell us.
Another language.
Yeah.
Yeah. So ginger, the ginger-based drink, right, that we make in Guinea, is called ginger. Now,
okay.
Now, it doesn't mean none of the languages in Guinea, it doesn't mean ginger in any of the languages in Guinea. It's a specific name for the liquid beverage, that specific liquid beverage. And for example, ginger in my native language, Fulani, is Nyamakuledi. Oh, right? It means pepper of the earth. And so if you were to go to places like Ivory Coast or Mali, you know, where you have more of the Mandingo speakers, they're calling Yamakuji, right? Same thing.
Oh, so that wouldn't easily roll off the tongue for us.
Not as easily. So it's a total coincidence that ginger sounds like ginger.
Yeah.
And it just made sense to use it.
Yeah, that's good branding. So I wanted to talk about your cafe in Harlem. Because we'll delve into the business of the drink itself after the break. But I wanted to talk specifically about the cafe. Like, why a cafe? So you've done, I don't know if it was always in the plan, but you've done, you know, the beverage. It's doing fairly well. Why did you want to settle yourselves with the brick and mortar store? And then why Harlem specifically too?
So the strategy from this was part of the strategy from the very beginning. The way we see this evolving and is, you know, the plan with the cafes is to have them, you know, have a number of them in major metro areas. So imagine like a few of these in New York City, places like, you know, DC, Atlanta, Houston, Seattle, London, you name it, right? Like major metropolitan areas, is to have the cafes in those locations. And the reason why we felt that a cafe had to be part of the you know, the strategy is that, you know, we're trying to sell African culture. We're trying to, you know, demystify the products, cultures, and people of Africa, right? And it's hard to accomplish that with just a packaged product because there's only so much you can communicate on a bottle, on a label, on a bottle. So the cafes, when you walk into them, you know, from the decor to the music to the flavors, right? It's meant to give you this, you know, experience, like you know, like this experience of African culture in a way that you could not get with just interacting with a label. So that's really the idea. You walk in there, you're sitting in there, you might walk in and just get a latte and not get one of our specialty beverages, right? So we not just ginger, but we right now we already have our next, the next three SKUs that we roll out, the hibiscus-based drink, we call it Bisap. There's like two teas, one is a Moroccan mentee called Latai, and the other one is a Kenkeliba. It's this like hardy bush that grows on marginal lands throughout West Africa. That's amazing in terms of its health benefits that we're also selling there. So the cafe allows us to not only feature some of those products on there and use it as a testing ground for some of those products before we shift them into like a packaged drink that we're distributing through either direct to consumer online or through using third party retailers.
All of us at HRN have been keeping busy despite working and recording from home. This fall, we're proud to announce new shows on the network that each bring important and enlightening stories to listeners around the world. While the world is in turmoil and the future of our country is uncertain, there are certain constants that help keep us going. For us, food and storytelling are essential. While we can't come together in person, food podcasts from HRN can provide a virtual table we can all gather around. Bringing exceptional stories to your ears and keeping you informed on the ever-changing political and environmental issues of our time is integral to our mission. At a time when the world around us is rapidly changing, HRN is committed to being here for our listening community, and we need you to be here for us. Join our table and help ensure the future of food radio by becoming a member of HRN. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to make a contribution. Check out the latest additions to our lineup while you're there. You can see all of our series at heritageradionetwork.org/new shows.
We had to cut off our first half of our conversation, our first third of our conversation, actually, with Raheem, because Seattle had a brief power outage. And so these things that you expect in Africa happen right here. And actually, Seattle is a big tech hub now, right, too. So it's interesting that it would happen here with all of our high tech stuff. And then we were just shut off. So, but the good thing about it is that we are now joined by the other half of Gingin Brothers.
Yes.
Which is great. So things always happen the way they're supposed to in that sense. So we're glad to have you on, Mohammed. Maybe do you want to introduce yourself a little bit before we jump back into where we were at in the interview?
Yeah, I'm glad to be here. My name is Mohammed Diallo. I'm the other half of Gingin Bros. The skinnier looking older brother. Yeah, and that's really it. I think I keep it brief, and people will get to know more as we speak, I think.
Sure, cool. So when we spoke with Raheem last time, we talked a little bit about how you guys came to the US, your early memories of food and cooking, and what brought you to starting the Gingin brand of drinks. But before going into the specifics of that business, I wanted you guys to tell us why you decided to saddle yourselves with a brick and mortar store, why you chose to have a cafe, why you chose to have it in Harlem in particular. What is the thought process behind that?
Yeah, we've been asking ourselves that same question lately. the brick and mortar has always been in the equation, to be honest with you. The plan was initially, you know, once we put together this amazing business, we raise hundreds of millions of dollars, we grow the business all over the country. A few years in, we would get the cafes going, we would open a cafe here and there and expand at that point. But what we realize is the reality is quite different in terms of getting funding for, you know, people with our background. You know, we don't necessarily, we don't have the ideal profile, let's say, for what investors, CPGs, VCs necessarily look for in the initial phase. So we have to make sure that we can prove to them that we are the real deal, that we can do and we can deliver upon what we're promising them. So from the packaging goods side of things, we managed to do that really well with the one drink. But the challenge was still, getting that that image or sort of selling them on what the larger, the bigger picture. You know, they didn't understand beyond what they saw and they tried, which was simply the ginger drink. What we're trying to achieve is a full CPG company that also had hospitality embedded in it. You know, a brand that can house all these different amazing products from back home, essentially. Because we weren't able to convey that message thoroughly, we decided, you know, perhaps if you do Even with the ginger drink, people didn't quite get it until they saw it and they tried it and they tasted it. But perhaps if you'd give something more comprehensive, something like a space people can come into and get immersed into the culture, listen to the music, the smell, the taste, the sound, try these other drinks like the Sorello, Zobo, Isap, you know, try some of our food, like the grains and stuff that we have back home and the sauces. Perhaps the picture would be more vivid and clear. Quite frankly, it worked pretty well, you know, until we closed in March due to COVID. Yeah. And it was going amazingly well. We had rave reviews. People all of a sudden came in and they knew about all these other drinks that we were trying to serve. And when investors or other people that we're trying to talk to came in and spoke to us, we didn't have to say that much because they saw everything and they tried it and they believed in it. And you know, it's nothing feels better than people walking in and say, yo, Starbucks got nothing on you guys. Like, this place is better than Starbucks. I would rather come in here than go anywhere else. So really it was just to show that we can execute at that level. We can have a space and a place and provide quality products that are that good and that excellent. You know, it's all about the quality of the product is very good, but also presentation is extremely important. And we were able to put all of that together with the cafe.
Yeah, and I agree. And I can speak firsthand because I've been to the cafe a couple of times. And I think just by like you said, there's a certain pride, at least for me, having sort of been in this space now for 5+ years. I look at a lot of brands for lack of a better term. And there's a certain pride when you walk into a space like that not only sort of captures your identity or tells your culture, your story in this, in a way that you recognize, but it's also done at a level that you can be proud of, that you can say, hey, like my friend from, you know, Italy or wherever, like I'm going to take you to this place that, you know, shows you a little bit more about who I am and where I'm from and all of that stuff. And I follow that. So the people that are telling you that this has got nothing on Starbucks, yes, there's that. But then also from a person that's African, there's that connection to it.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that I think is hard to replicate. So kudos to you guys. And one of the things I wanted, even before you had the cafe, I think you may be underselling yourselves in terms of the story you're trying to tell and branding and your brand identity. I think it's pretty strong. I think you can, just by virtue of being on your website, on Instagram, on social, all of that. Did you have a particular, I guess, story that you wanted to tell? Or what's the overall vision in terms of the quote unquote African story that you're trying to tell through your brand identity, whether it's through the interior design, through the logo design?
I guess the story we're trying to communicate to the world really is that, you know, that the people of Africa, the people that come from the continent and the products that we have on the continent and really everything associated with Africa is a lot more than the narrative that folks outside of Africa have, you know, essentially have known all their whole lives, right? So typically you mention Africa to folks that don't know of the continent or are not really, you know, as I guess, that don't know as much about the world outside of wherever they come from. It tends to not be a positive image they get of Africa, mm-hmm. right? It's ideas of corruption, ideas of poverty. It's just, you know, this basket case of the continent that just needs people to come out from the outside and save them, right? And you think about, we had a lady, this has happened a number of occasions. We'll have people come into the coffee shop and ask, you know, when we tell them our beans, our drip coffee is a blend of beans from Africa, Congo, Rwanda, and Ethiopia, you'll have people that don't know that there's coffee in Africa, literally.
Right.
And you know, whereas coffee comes from Africa, right?
Yeah. So
I had a Colombian couple once come sit there. You know, you could tell they're tourists. They ordered coffee. They had the latte and a cappuccino, I believe it was, and they just loved it. So I come over to clear their plates, and she asked the lady asked me, "Is this Colombian coffee?" We're like, you know, right? You could tell Colombian. I said, do you like it? She goes, yeah, it's amazing. And then I tell her it's not Colombian coffee. And I explained to her what the blend is. Mm-hmm. And she was surprised that there's coffee as good as whatever she perceives Colombian coffee to be, right? But that's not from coffee, it's from Colombia. And even more so that it's from Africa, right? Like this woman from Colombia takes pride in coffee, but doesn't know that these are beans that probably started their lives somewhere in East Africa. You know what I mean? Like the transport. There. So just generally changing that that view people have of Africa. And you know, we tell this to folks often, we could have done this in other spaces, in media and fashion and you name it. It just so happens that food has a unique food. You can embrace another culture through the food in a way that you cannot do anything else, right? It's harder to learn a language or to pack your bags and go and travel around Africa and get to learn Africa that way. But you can go to, if we had places like the Jinjin Cafe, you know, throughout the world, you can have people go in there. And even if that doesn't necessarily completely change their mindset, their view of African Africans, it will at least have something else that's positive in their mind that they can associate with Africa beyond whatever preconceived notions they have, you know? So it's that, just essentially just highlighting the fact that we capable of executing at the highest level just like everyone else, and that our products should be, you know, everywhere just like everyone else's products are in Africa. That's more or less that's a long-winded way of telling you we just want to tell the story of Africa.
I agree. And it's even with the coffee. Are you going to say something?
Yeah, it's Mohammed now, but if I may jump in quickly, one thing we did not want to compromise on was quality. We noticed that whenever we mentioned our products, and of course we too had frustration of going into certain markets and seeing the branding was a bit poor, but we realized one of the biggest difference between our products and other products out there in the market is really just a lack of an absence of branding or taking branding more seriously. Mm. So I say this because what we did is looks good and it even looks simple sometimes, but it really was quite difficult. We went through over 70 different designers. Get to what we wanted to have, simply because the stereotype is everywhere. They don't do it in purpose, but every designer, brand designer that we went to was giving us stuff like with like an African lady holding something on their head,
like a souvenir shop,
you know,
designing a souvenir shop,
you know, like just everything stereotypical about Africa. Mm. Like that's the type. We were like, listen, perhaps we should tell you to forget about Africa as a whole. Just make the best possible looking brand that you can. And communicating even that was difficult the moment we mentioned Africa. So we really, really had to be extremely patient and just go through people and have the courage to say, no, sorry, you're close, but not quite there. No, thank you, thank you, thank you. So, we just have to take ourselves also serious enough to know that, you know, if our qualities are of great product and if we can just also make it look as good.
Thank you, Bintasi. Our products have a great quality.
Yeah. We have great quality products. Yeah, exactly. Great quality part. And if you can simply get the look, the brand, and take everything else that comes along with it more seriously, everyone else has no choice but to take us seriously, in essence. And I think that's how we will change the narrative of Africa from what we're doing here to what you're doing. What you're doing is also very high quality. So it's all of those things that needs to come together for Africa to be viewed in a slightly better light, or in the way that we know that it is or it can be.
Yeah. As you were talking about the quality of your product, it made me start to think, I'm now going to transition into talking about the CPG, the food business, packaging business in particular, and how challenging it can be. One, starting just with regulations, right? So talking about quality reminds me of my brother actually started a juice business some time ago, wasn't able to follow through with it for a variety of reasons. But one of the things that he found challenging was meeting like FDA standards for the things that, or the claims that were on the label, right? So if I remember correctly, you can correct me if I'm wrong, because I don't have the bottle in front of me. I think your drink is considered or labeled organic and GMO free, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's at least organic. Yeah. So if people are thinking about entering, and a lot of people that are doing this want to enter into the space and are looking at juices specifically, are probably going to go that route because of the signal of quality of health. What are the, in terms of labeling and meeting regulations, what are some of the hurdles or what are some of the considerations people need to think about as they put together a product for?
So, you know, food is very heavily regulated. I mean, if you think about the fact that the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, right? So it's regulated at the same level as drugs. Rightfully so. And depending on where you are, I mean, we're in the U.S., so we'll just focus on cases that are specific to the U.S. Each state has different regulatory bodies that you might fall under, right? So in New York, for example, we have to be inspected by the Department of Agriculture, and that's a state department. But if you're a brick and mortar location that's like the cafe, that has to be inspected by the Department of Health of the city of New York. So there's a local level that we have to deal with in New York City for the cafe. And then for the packaged goods, we have to, register with the FDA and then be inspected by the Department of Agriculture of the state of New York, right? So, and then you have the voluntary sort of regulatory stuff you have to comply with for, say, for any sort of, any claims. The non-GMO certifications, the organic certification. And it's not just applying for it and getting the pay, you know, getting approved for the first time. It's an ongoing compliance burden, right? Because you get inspected annually, but you have to track all your, all the ingredients you use, everything. There's a very specific documentation you have to have in place that they can come in and audit once a year and, you know, decide whether you can keep your certification or not, right? So that's really the main areas you have to deal with. The FDA is not a regulatory body per se, right? They don't come and inspect you, but you have to be registered with them just in case what recalls and things like that. And they issue guidance on regulation for the states and the local municipalities to take and enforce, right? So they will issue guidance on how to, say, police the juice business, and the Department of Agriculture at the state level will adapt, more often than not, adapt those recommendations, but they might take it and adjust it a little bit. And that's the body you're interfacing with as a brand to stay in compliance. Now, it's a lot of paperwork, but honestly,
I was gonna ask.
It's not impossible. And one thing I would share with, you know, some of your audience, even if it's not just in the food space, really, one thing I've learned over the last, I don't know, 6 years or so, is that most of what you're doing in your business is paperwork, right? It's sort of kind of intuitive. You'll think that it's a lot of the things you're getting up and doing, you know, the making the product, but the most important aspects of your business will be paperwork related, you know, whether you're complying with, you know, financial regulation stuff or something specific regulations to your industry. But again, none of this is impossible. And if you're in the US, in the Western world in general, it's relatively straightforward because you can look it up. You know what I mean? You can Google it. Like I think folks doing this in Africa have a much tougher time. On one hand, regulation is not that strict, but on the other hand, you also don't have access to as many resources. I'm not even talking about money, but I'm talking more about data and information and just a supply network that would be around you, things like that.
And then, so you said you generally just look it up and do, but just by virtue of the volume of paperwork, not just with the food regulations, but everything else, do you ever outsource or have you thought about outsourcing some of that just to give you more flexibility with operations? Or do you do everything yourself?
As much, honestly, if you have someone you can outsource it to, if you can afford to outsource it, wherever you can hire someone that, you know, that knows what they're doing better than you do, you know, as an entrepreneur, that's your job really, is to put those people in place. But in our case, we pretty much didn't outsource anything simply because we didn't have two things. One, we couldn't afford it. You know, food consultants are very expensive. And two, since we couldn't afford it, we also, you know, we have the skill set to learn things like this and in a relatively short time and implement them just by virtue of our educational background. So I think, you know, most people that have had some sort of, that are comfortable with, you know, administrative work, you know, paperwork and, or that have a background in, really that have an, you know, advanced education of some kind ought to be able to do it themselves if they want to. But again, if you can afford it, can get someone that knows what they're doing better than you, hire someone and let them do it the time.
Yeah. And then I guess my last question around the food regulation piece before we move forward is around staying through to like the recipe, right? So if I recall, you know, you sort of had to call your mom to put the first original recipe together. But then in terms of, it's a perishable product, right? So in terms of, I'm sure there's, I don't know, regulations around, you know, keeping it shelf stable or whatever to make sure that it can last for X number of days. Does that affect like the authenticity? Like, do you have to change certain things so that it's not as maybe quote unquote authentic as you would like, or?
No. So in terms of the shelf stability of the product, it's up to you. You know, you have a lot of options in terms of how to extend the shelf life of your product.
Yeah.
As far as the regulatory bodies are concerned, they only care that whatever it is that you adopt is safe, right? Okay. So they only care about protecting the safety of the consumer. Now, you extend the shelf life mainly not because of a safety issue, but because business-wise, you cannot sell a product that expires in 3 days, right? You don't have enough time. So, you know, that's whatever option you choose to use as a shelf life extending method, whether it's using preservatives, whether it's using like heat to pasteurize it, whether it's some more novel techniques like high pressure processing, or you're using something like using ozone to sanitize it and extend the shelf life. Regardless of what you use, you have to make sure that it's either a method that's already been approved for your types of products. So for example, if you're doing a beverage that has a certain pH, you need to, in order for you to say use regular heat pasteurization techniques, there are standards where you have to hold that liquid at a certain temperature, I think it's around 160, for 30 seconds or longer, right? I forget the exact number, but it's around there. And that's guaranteed to kill whatever pathogenic agent that normally would survive in that sort of environment, right? And so on and so forth. So depending on what your pH is, what your ingredients are, whether you're using preservatives or not, you just need to make sure you're using things that are either already approved, that's on a list of approved compounds by the regulatory bodies, or you can go to say a lab, like in New York, you could go to Cornell University and they'll run some of these tests for you. They'll do a validation study, meaning they'll take it and run it through the process that you say you will use to produce your product, and then test the shelf life of it and tell you, okay, this is a method that has been validated to kill like 5 logs of, you know, pathogenic compound that would be in it. I'm getting a little technical.
I think it's helpful. A lot of people don't get this level of detail as you think about it. They think, oh, I make the best, I don't know, watermelon juice. I'm going to try to do this. And then they run into some of these stumbling blocks. So I think it's helpful.
I think we are, you know, we did too, you know, I mean, going into it, you have no idea what to look out for. But again, once you know who's regulating you, you can literally reach out to the regulatory body, tell them exactly what you're doing, and you'll find them very helpful. And the shelf life, if you say, you know, this is something you can do beforehand, you can test the shelf life just roughly yourself at home, right? Like say, you know, your drink will last maybe a week for sure, because you've experienced, you know that. So you can make, say, 4 containers, seal them, test one at a week, test one at 10 days or 14 days, and keep going.
until you get sick.
until you feel like, okay, I should not be testing this anymore. You know, I don't recommend you do this at home, right? Because I don't want anyone to get sick at home and come to Raheem, give me
the money. Yeah.
But that's essentially what the lab does. They'll tell you, okay, how long do you want to study the shelf life for? You say 6 months or 1 year. And then they'll ask you how many points do you want to check it on, meaning how many different frequent intervals. So you can tell them, all right, test it for 6 months and test 4 intervals. So they can test it at 1 month, at 3 months, 4 months, and so on.
Okay.
Yeah. And then they'll give you a report, like a biochemical, literally report that tells you, okay, this is only safe for 45 days or 6 or 2 months. Yeah. And so on. Yeah.
Wow, this is definitely not your grandmother's business for sure. Interesting. Okay, so let's move on to what I'm sure is the topic that most people are looking to dive into, which is funding. All right, mm-hmm. So you guys, at least from the outside, looks like you've ramped up relatively quickly in terms of just the business, and then also the underlying assumption there is that there's been funding to support that growth, right? And so from what I know, and you can talk about it, you've done that through a mix of different sorts of, I would call them capital raises, just from my banking background, but you've done grants, you've done crowdfunding. I think you've done some VC funding, I'm not sure. And then you've just had some angel investors too, I think. So do you want to, I'll just leave it open to talk about the various ways you funded it and, you know, what worked, what didn't work from your perspective.
Yeah, so, you know, if you start a business, I would say you need to have a very strong desire to make it succeed beyond just money, because it's never it's never easy. It's always very, very difficult. And we had our mindset on from the beginning, if we had to make one bottle of this thing, sell it and make two, sell those, make three or four, we would do that. And we were prepared for that. We knew it would be difficult, but and it still was not was much more difficult than how difficult it was. You know, for us, especially, you know, immigrants, not just Africans, you know, that come here and most of our family are still back home, our realities are very different. Like, it's very hard for us to save money because they have to send money back home. It's very hard to do so many things because there's all these different pressures. Oh, you should build a house home. You should do this. You should do that. So getting a big amount of savings is quite challenging. So when we launched this business, when we decided we would launch it, by the way, we had been talking about this and thinking about this, how the brand identity would look for a while at that point. When we finally decided we'd launch this, all we had at our disposal was a little less than $1,000.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and that's no lie. So we said, okay, is this enough to do anything? My brother, I remember him saying, well, we can register a company.
I was going to say, it sounds to me like you can register a company and that's about it.
All right, that's a start. And I guess I can put my next salary into this. I mean, we can start buying ingredients and playing around with it and we can get going that way. And, you know, some of the advice you hear out there often, I'll go on a tangent a little bit here, because all of the books written, the MBA books, the major university advice, it's amazing advice. It's excellent advice. The only problem is it does not take into account the problems that I just told you about or the challenges of some people who come really from very unique and difficult circumstances. It looks at people who normally maybe graduated from college, one got an amazing job, saved ton of money, or got funding through a friend or family round and such. So meaning around $100,000 to $200,000, got the thing started, had a proof of concept, goes and raises $1 million, and then they go boom. And from there, they go and they raise $10 million. So that's not the reality of most of our people, unfortunately. You know, we can barely come across $50,000, you know, to do anything. So, and that's the reality that came really quickly. When we did the math, we needed 1.5 million to get started.
Oh, wow. Whoa.
Yeah.
Wait.
So what for what we wanted to do, the way we wanted to do it properly, we needed 1.5 million.
Oh, wow. We're like, okay.
I think this is doable.
Wow. Wait. Let's pause. So yeah. So really speaking now to we have a wide audience, but the people that are going to focus in on this are a lot of African immigrants who have businesses in this space. And just from by virtue of my experience of talking to a broad range of people, from whether it's service hospitality to actual packaged goods. Yeah. I don't think I've ever met or spoken to anyone who did the math before jumping in to know that they needed X number. People usually jump in and then figure it as they go along, and it's like, whoa. So like what, I mean, not without, maybe it's too technical, but how do you arrive at a 1.5 million number for a juice business?
Again, just a side note, if you're listening to this, and you don't do the math before you jump, please do the math before you jump.
With all seriousness, though, if you do the math, then you won't get surprised when you get knocked out.
Yeah.
You know? It's like, oh, of course I knew it. What it would allow you to do is just be more realistic and try to figure out a different angle or different way of doing things. Okay. So the math is extremely important. But yeah, thanks for pointing that out. But we did have to do the math because we wanted to know what to do, how to do it, and how to do it right. And the way we came to that was simply what we thought at first was the most realistic way of doing it, meaning doing part of the production ourselves with needing certain equipment, doing the another part with a co-packer, because then we don't have to shell out something like, I think most, if you want a full line, in high-end full line, you can spend anywhere between $10 million dollars or
Whoa.
More build out your own facility with everything, all the so you know, I've seen numbers up to 75 million, you know.
Yeah.
So you can, this
depending
number can vary
to build,
and can go yeah. really 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 high really really fast. So we thought, we narrowed that down to 1.5 million, you know. We would just need this and that, we would get our suppliers this way, we would get our bottling that way, we would have this many people to start with in our team. And that was, we thought, very conservative. And so we had our business plan. We called a couple of friends. We were so excited. We presented it to them. And then they gave us a look like we were crazy, rightfully so. We presented to a few other people, and we quickly realized as this was going on that we would never get that money.
So the you wanted to know what went into that math, right? It's very straightforward. We thought we need a facility to make it in. We need certain equipment to do one part of the process, like my brother alluded to, and then second part to the good use the co-packer. We needed a truck to distribute all that and, like, you know, do some marketing locally. We needed sales and marketing people to build the brand when once we go live. So really, we just simulated what the company would look like if we launch, like if we need an accountant, all of that. I mean, the ideal scenario to launch it. You know what I mean? And we added, we put a price tag and all of that. How much does an accountant cost? How much space do we need? What's the rent for a space like that in the South Bronx where there are a bunch of factories or whatever you want to, like, on and on and on. And then enough
and not
cash.
To ignore the store counts that we want to start with. So do we want to start with 100 locations? Do we want to go push and try to grow into 1,000 locations? So all that goes into that. And then how much do you take? What's the starting capital for that?
And then enough runway for, say, 6 months to a year.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you. So it's not just the CapEx at the beginning, but you're also looking at operating expenses for X number of months post-launch. Okay, got it. Wow. That for me would be scary. Like, that would be scary. That would be daunting just to see that number. But you're right. I think it would be helpful to see the number and then, like, sort of maybe shock you into reality as you think about the different options you have.
Absolutely.
And it was then that it, you know, we almost gave up at that point because it's like, okay, there's no way we can get 1.5 million. We're talking to people and they're looking at us like, you know, giving us that look. And so that's when it dawned upon us, hey, if our mother can make this in their kitchen, you know, and give it to us or sell it on the side of the street, there's got to be a much cheaper way of doing this. And it wasn't easy to find that formula or to figure out a way to do it and scale it at that smaller level. It was extremely difficult, but we figured because people were just saying, okay, this is a really good idea. Like, you know, anyone who knows Africa or who's had the product, the first few people that we presented were people that had a little bit of money that we knew about in the community through introductions and such. So they understood it, but they just didn't believe in it. They thought it was too ambitious. It was just too big of a thing to do. So, and they wanted to see what the product was. So we went on and we said, okay, let's go ahead and create a product and show them the product, you know, and we did that. And eventually then they went, okay, you have the product, you have 2 or 3 stores, but can you really get into stores? Can you get into more stores? We went and got into 30 to 40 stores by ourselves while holding a full-time job. It was our bi-weekly checks that was funding this, by the way, as okay. We were going.
Okay, so then initially, it's your salaries, right? So
yeah,
that's the
initially initial... it's our salary, and then we ran into eventually one person that actually believed in us a little bit, he gave us he made a small investment that allowed us to say, okay, now we can go and try to see if we can get a distributor really quickly. And at the same time, we engaged Whole Food immediately. But this was a very modest investment.
It was $25,000.
Yeah. Yeah, so...
That was our first outside money.
Yeah, that's... I mean, again, a relative, right? So for our community, someone hears that, they're like, whoa. But I guess, relatively speaking, in terms of the bigger market that you're competing in, you're right, that's probably not significant.
That's what I call a dangerous amount of money.
You know what we call that?
No.
Just enough rope to hang yourself. Enough to get you deep into the thing and then you're out of money.
Oh, before boy.
So essentially, that money ran out fast. But thankfully, we were able to secure Whole Food by name. We were able to get a distributor as well. And we had been applying nonstop. So if you cannot get funding the traditional route, you got to find out a creative way. So every competition that we heard of, whether it's $1,000 prize or $10,000 or $100,000, we would enter the competition.
Okay.
And we thought the hope was to at least be finalists, even if you don't win, just the presence of just our presence at the event, or the people will get to hear and see the brand.
We were applying to things we knew for sure we don't qualify for, right? Like, it's like some competition on, you know, artificial intelligence, you know, software, right? We'll apply to it. I'm not joking when I say this. I, you know, and now our whole thinking was, one person is going to review these applications. That person will know our brand exists from now.
Yeah.
You know, that was literally, we have time, we don't have money. So anything that that's how we used our time, more or less.
So game changer. So there's a lot of, as you can see, as much as we're good at planning, there was a lot of willpower and devotion to suffering. Allowing ourselves to suffer because as we were running out of money, we were lucky enough, we won 2 prizes within the same month, which was we won the FedEx National Grand Prize contest, which was a $25,000 award, and we won an American Entrepreneurship Award, which was also $25,000.
Oh, nice!
That just changed. It was the first time we had enough money to be able to actually do something, to do a little bit of test marketing here and there, to allow ourselves to get into more accounts and amongst other things. So for us, that was a game changer. So if you're paying attention, we still have not gotten money to this point.
This was about a year and a half in.
Okay. Yeah, so at this point, year and a half in, you've essentially bootstrapped, right, with salaries and then now grants at this point.
Exactly.
And at that point, the two of us were working full time and doing the job of about a dozen people. So no sleep.
Crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy.
But this is what it takes for us to be able to do things like this, to grow things like this. And our belief is, as long as you're willing to go on and you keep going and you do so, things that are just excellent, somebody out there will eventually see you and appreciate what you do and accept the greatness of what you're doing and come along. So
we're still looking for those people, by the way.
If you're out there and you're still looking.
Yeah, so essentially we kept trying to raise. Here is the thing too. If you get to start your business and you're actually doing okay and you're surviving and you're trying to build it, another decision we made earlier was we were never going to undersell ourselves. We would never, out of desperation, make a stupid decision, you know. I don't know if my brother mentioned this before. We got invited to, a potential investor invited us to Hong Kong.
I haven't heard this.
Yeah, like, you know, flight, hotel all paid for. We get there, you know, we're having dinner in Michelin star hotels, restaurants. And we get in there, there's a lot of, the dinner is pretty much intimidating. It's his best. It's his accountant from all over the world and all of these different people. And after all of that, we get essentially insulted and given like a quite poor offer. Now, for most people at that point, especially given the situation we were in.
Yeah, the Michelin stars.
Yeah, they was like, oh my God, you know. And it was a really hard decision because we really, really needed that at that time. And we were in a really difficult spot. But we had to turn it down. And it was a lot of money, you know. So
relatively speaking. Well, it was 350K. It was 350K, roughly around there. For a ridiculous percentage of the business.
I was gonna say. So this was an equity. So they wanted equity in the business. Okay, so not an outright sale.
No.
Yeah. No. I mean, we were willing to give up quite a bit of equity, but it was just insane. You know what they were asking for. So I mean, if you end up working so hard and eventually you find yourself towards where you want to be, but then you're working for someone else again, then that's not very joyful, you know. We do want to, and the other thing is, you got to think about how big you want to make your business. If you took that and we gave up half of it, we would never have enough of the business remaining to do the following round to get the business to where it needs to be. So that's that. So eventually, we left that, and we had a couple of other meetings with a few other people. You know, at that point, we were more excited because at least we were finally getting meetings. You know,
we turned it down, by the way.
Yeah, but I think that also should send a signal to you, right, that you're on the right track, even if the valuation at that point is not what you think it is. I think, as a budding entrepreneur, that should the fact that someone is even willing to put down some money should, you know, set up.
Totally,
no,
it was a fantastic experience. We enjoyed it a lot.
It's funny, it was an odd thing, right? Because on one side, you know, we're putting on our entrepreneurial hats on and going, no, this is a horrible day, we're not making the deal. But at the same time, we're going, man, I can believe somebody wants to give us $350,000. You know what I mean? For any percentage of our business, you know? So you're right. It was very validating.
Yeah. And really, we got the best we could out of it. You know, whenever we meet with someone, even if we, whether they say no or we say no, we always took the best out of it. We got as much advice as we could out of it. You know, even if 80% of it is nonsense, that 20% is the most valuable thing. And we take that and we just use that for the following meeting or the following person we have to speak to. So, you know, it's very, very challenging to, you know, how do you value a company you've killed yourself to build?
Right.
But yet, you know, you're not able to take advantage of all of the opportunities that are in front of you because you will, that's the other thing. We have had so many people reach out to a store in terms of stores to expand, to grow. We keep saying no. Because we know we will grow ourselves out of business.
Oh, got it.
So it's very important to know your limits too and just keep yourself there till you know you're ready to get to the next step. If you can find a way to make that work, congratulations to you. But for us, it's very important to say, thank you so much, but not yet. You know, give us a little bit more time. You know, we're working towards being able to work with you and get into the place we need to be. But, you know, just give us a little bit more time. So as we kept doing this, it just got harder and harder and harder. But at the same time, we had a lot of friends reaching out to us saying, hey, I love what you guys are doing. At that time, we were becoming a bit more visible. Mm. And people that realized that, you know, we were really serious about this. It wasn't just something we started for fun and friends would call and say, hey, I have $500. I would love to invest in your company or $1,000 here and there. And we kept saying no, because it just wasn't enough for us to do much of anything. And then we would have taken their money. But as this kept growing, we said, what are we doing? Why are we saying no to these people? There's a lot of them, and they want to work with us. They want to be part of what we're doing. And literally, like, there's nothing better than having your friends win if you end up winning at the end of the day. So, and so we did an equity crowdfunding campaign.
Oh, in which we raised $182,000,
essentially, from 261 investors. It was amazing. And around that time, we had also decided to open up the cafe and get that going. And that's how we got to where we are. So no $1 million investment. It's really just our strong desire to build this thing, no matter what it takes, and a few lucky breaks in terms of winning those grants. The way I see it is either we will eventually get
the big investor,
the big investment required to scale this and grow this quickly, because we do have everything in place to get that done quickly, or it will be a slow, small, gradual build. You know, one cafe now, maybe a second one, and then eventually we'll, as we grow throughout the Northeast, we'll eventually go to other regions and territories as we grow, and it'll be a nice, slow build, and we will have to be extremely patient in that way. But it's one or the other. We would love to get the investment, but if it doesn't come, we're not going anywhere. Like, we'll find other ways.
So are you both now working on this full time? Do you have a team? Like, what's the current status in terms of working versus the brand?
Oh yeah, we're on this full time. The two of us are on it full time. We have a designer that we have on retainer that, you know, creates some of the visuals that you see on social media and places like that. We ended up having to let go of pretty much most of our employees at the cafe, and we have one employee there. So it's just it's not much has changed. So we've built quite a bit since we started.
Yeah.
We don't have this massive team behind us that we're that's powering everything you're seeing. We're in the process of actually raising a larger round with the idea of expanding, because we have a distributor that covers most of the the East Coast, really, that has over 4,000 points of sale we can do. Yeah. So like, we can literally activate that next week if we could. But putting product in 4,000 locations and not have sales and marketing team to support it is suicide, right?
Yeah.
We're in Whole Foods already, but
ask you about that.
Yeah, so we're in there, but then we could grow into more other stores. But again, in order for us to do that, we need personnel that we have to hire and pay and make all that happen. So really, we're in the middle of we're in the middle of raising capital again. But this one, hopefully.
We're a little more optimistic this time.
Are you, so when you say raising capital, is this, are you looking at VCs? Like, what channel are you going down for this one?
Both, we're looking to raise anywhere, on the low end, $2 million, on the high end, more than $5 million this round. And really the difference, you might wonder why it's such a big range. It's really doing more or less of the same thing we would do, right? It's just, if we raise more money, we can move quicker, we can open more quicker, we can expand our footprint in the retail quicker, we can add on, activate more of the SKUs that we already are selling at the coffee shop. So we have four drinks altogether.
E-com,
do be more aggressive online. So that's it. It's on a lower end. We'll do a little less of that, and we're targeting VCs, angels. Pretty much anyone that's looking to put some money to work.
Awesome. So I actually wanted to talk to you about VC funding in general, because back to, I think it was Mohammed's point earlier about us not being the right fit sometimes for these funding models or capital raising models, just by virtue of what people are looking for, or the typical entrepreneur that they're looking for, what they're looking to invest in. Just based on your discussions, experiences with different VCs, if there have been that many, I guess for the people that are listening, want them to get a sense of a flavor, what it's like to interact with VCs with a product like yours that's sort of steeped in African cultural context and what that means when you're talking, I'm guessing, mostly to American VCs.
All of us at HRN have been keeping busy despite working and recording from home. This fall, we're proud to announce new shows on the network that each bring important and enlightening stories to listeners around the world. While the world is in turmoil and the future of our country is uncertain, there are certain constants that help keep us going. For us, food and storytelling are essential. While we can't come together in person, food podcasts from HRN can provide a virtual table we can all gather around. Bringing exceptional stories to your ears and keeping you informed on the ever-changing political and environmental issues of our time is integral to our mission. At a time when the world around us is rapidly changing, HRN is committed to being here for our listening community, and we need you to be here for us. Join our table and help ensure the future of food radio by becoming a member of HRN. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to make a contribution. Check out the latest additions to our lineup while you're there. You can see all of our series at heritageradionetwork.org/new shows.
Here's the thing with VCs. First and foremost, they want to invest in things that make money, right? So the first thing they look for is that. They're looking for companies that are already making money, pretty much de-risk altogether, and you know, it's, they just put in their money and harvest at the end. Now, of course, you see the reaction, obvious reaction to that is, well, duh, right?
Yeah.
So, short of that, it's okay. You want to have enough signals for them to believe that you're going to make them a lot of money.
Yeah.
So if it's a venture capitalist that invest in later stage companies, that's a lot easier. You have a lot more metrics to go off of and so on. If it's people that invest in early stage companies, if you're at the idea stage or you just literally just have a proof of concept and a nice PowerPoint, right now they have to look to other indicators or whatever it is that in their minds convinces them that you fit the profile of someone that can make this happen. So these indicators, the most obvious ones tend to be your pedigree, where you went to school, mm-hmm. right? If you went to an Ivy League, that gets you through the door in some ways, and so on. Now, the other thing that comes into play there is race. Unfortunately, because that does factor in, right? They look for VCs that fit a pattern of something they know. So if you're a venture capitalist, all the only people you've seen succeed in whatever space are young white kids that went to a certain school, that's what you're going to look for. Because yeah. If you invest in those guys and it doesn't pan out, no one's going to give you a hard time. You invest in someone that does not fit the mold and it doesn't pan out, you have a lot more explaining to do. Right. This is just me giving them the benefit of doubt at some point, you know.
Yeah.
Beyond that, you have those that really just don't believe, that would not invest in young black kids because, you know, it's a society they grew up in and they have no indicator that people like us can do things like this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And really that's the way I look at it. And so for us, we have the added challenge of, okay, we're young black immigrants. The only two things that would have made it maybe more challenging is if you were a black woman or if you were, you know, black, you know, a female and handicapped at the same time. You're an immigrant, you know, you're black, you're a first time founder, all yeah. these come into play. So they keep moving the goalpost, right? Some people will say, oh, come see us when you have a distributor, right? You come back to them when you have, you come back, you have a distributor. Oh, come see me when you have, you know, who carries you? Like they want to know a big name anchor.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, we have Whole Foods. Okay, how many stores? You tell them. Okay, come back to us when you double that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So the goalpost keeps moving. So you have that. And yeah, that's. Yeah,
and if I may add, even if you don't look at it on a racial, these are biases that are built in that they don't even realize they are, even if they're not.
Exactly.
So one of the ways they get a lot of us out of the ability to be invested in or even apply is most VCs will ask for a minimum of $1 million revenue.
Yep. On a run rate of $1 million.
$1 million. How many people in our community do you know
yeah.
who start a business with even more than, you know, $50,000 or $100,000? Not many, but most of us save, we manage to save $5,000 to $10,000. We get something started. You know, we do maybe a revenue of $50,000 or $60,000, which is amazing. You know, I feel like, or even we may get close to the $100,000 after a year or two. And that to us, that's incredible. It's like, wow, like I built this from scratch, from nothing. And, but to them, it's like, well, we only look at business, you know, we only accept businesses on a run rate of $1 million or more. So by that virtue, you need to build your company up for like 10 years to get to that point to be able to even apply to them. And that's the challenge. If you're in tech, maybe you're lucky enough, you have a few co-founders that fit the right profile and everything else. Maybe they'll take a chance on you. But like just mainly being Black or a woman in general, it's you don't necessarily get the benefit of the doubt. Even if everything is perfect the way it should be, it can be a bit challenging sometimes. Most of the guys that these guys invest in, this is what happened, okay? Not all of them, but most of them, this is what happens. They like my brother was saying, and I said earlier, they went to the right school. They have an idea. They go, they do a friends and family round. Generally, you know, the median income of white America is much, much, much higher.
Yeah.
It's in 130 or 140 thousand.
117,000
average. And for Black Americans, it's around what last I checked was around 7,000. I think both of those numbers have gone up now. That's the median income of a family. It's a huge disparity. So when you're looking at friends and family, who has the most friends? So usually these guys will get funded by their mom and dad or their friends, or they have a home or two. They can put one on, you know, as collateral. So getting $100,000 to $500,000 just as a seed or to just get their idea started is fairly simple. And once they have the idea, like, hey, look, we have this. It tastes good. It looks good. We just need $750,000 to $1 million to get it going. And they can get that fairly easily or get a loan from a bank fairly easily because they have all these assets and all these other things they can put up. If you have $1 million, how hard is it for you to make another million? And now they're in a position to go after these VCs and get the money. So this is the somewhat of the frustration or some of the challenges that, you know, we tend to go through. But we just look at it as just a way of learning and finding out how things are and how things work. And eventually, ultimately, we will get to that. And then we will be able to, again, give them a chance to say no. But that's where we are, really. That's the challenge. But, you know, you're being a little more optimistic, if you are just thinking of starting the business in the early stages, your best bet is, you know, don't waste your time too much on bigger VCs who only fund, Series A and Series B. You know, go to the pre-seed or seed funds. You know, there's a lot of angel groups out there that are doing that. If you're a woman, there's actually a much bigger push now to fund women. And you will likely be able to get, you know, like a 10 to 25,000 investment if they really, really like what you do and they believe in what you do. But again, that's only going to be enough to get you started and get you going.
Enough rope, right?
Yeah. If you're at the idea stage, honestly, I would say don't waste any time going after anybody unless you're a proven entrepreneur, right? You can point to something you've done to a total stranger and they'll be like, oh, okay, right? Like some sort like that to give you validation. Maybe go after friends you may know, family you don't know. I will not say don't go to investors. Maybe you're much better, you know, at raising money than we are, right? But if I have to do this over again, knowing what I know today, some of the time we spent chasing after capital early on, because after the first year, we're like, all right, you know what? Every indicator that we've had is get a proof of concept, get some retailers, show that your product moves, then go out there and get a friends and family, like a pre-seed round. So we relaxed, we shifted our focus to that, and we ended up leading to nothing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I think especially if you don't have a product, don't even incorporate a company. Focus on getting your product. I'm serious. Yeah. Focus on getting your product right, getting something people like, people are going to, you know, buy, or, you know, or like, not just your friends tasting it and loving it, but something that someone will literally give you money for.
Yeah.
You know, and then start worrying about everything else. And after that, get the branding right. Try to get some retailers, get people paying you before you go to anyone trying to find money. Because otherwise, I this is my personal belief. I think you'll waste a lot of energy and not get as far.
No, I think you should definitely apply regardless in terms of pre-seed and seed round angel groups and VCs, simply because it will give you an opportunity to practice your pitch, you know, and enter competitions. Competitions are probably the best way, the easiest way to get something. It's still very challenging, but it's one of the way. But I think if anything, you may get something. If nothing, you know, be positive, you know, ask for questions, ask them why they're not picking you. And that may open up doors, or they may even give you a tip that actually may change how you do business completely. You know, sometimes it's not something really you can use or you can do. So you keep it moving. But you know, we've gotten some, we understood the psychology and gotten some really good feedback here and there with them. And some of them still reach back out to us because they're actually paying attention. They just don't want to take a risk. They want to wait till we are making money and their money is pretty much guaranteed. And at that point, we'll have the advantage.
Yeah.
But do that. And also, warm intros are amazing. You know, sometimes it's your customers. They'll know someone. They love what you do so much that they may introduce you to a person, and that warm intro may lead to something better than you would have a higher odds than let's say meeting a random investor.
Well, good advice. I'm just watching the time. I know we're over time. Just how much time do you have left? So we can start wrapping up. I know we've gone over.
10 minutes.
Okay, cool. Yeah. So just, I guess this is all really helpful. And as you were talking about, you know, the different conversations you're having with VCs and tips and whatnot, I remember a video, an anecdote I saw one of you share, I think it may have been Raheem actually, about someone who told you guys to tone down the Africa in your pitches. Yeah. And it just, like, I remember hearing that and just being so, because I feel like that is the selling point. I don't know what your take. I mean, obviously you haven't done that, but to hear that, for me, that's your unique selling proposition, right? And so to hear somebody say that to you, especially from their background, I think they work for a major bottler or something like that.
It was a former Coca-Cola employee, I think.
Exactly.
And he meant, honestly, like, you could tell that he meant well, you know? Like, this guy said that for a reason, right? If he's interacting with us for the first time ever, and that's the first thing that comes to mind, that goes to the point of us trying to do this to really change the way, you know, African everything is perceived. Coca-Cola sells millions upon millions of dollars worth of products in Africa. You know what I mean? This is how this guy still reacts. And honestly, we've had, you know, before we went live, we had Africans, you know, like, you think that it's too, I mean, we have the map of Africa in the middle of our logo. You know what I mean? It was too in your face. That's how they felt. But just the way you reacted, we felt like if we remove the African angle, the story of these products being, you know, like, traditional to us, or that has been in our families for generations and generations. If you remove all of that, we're just another company mixing juices and selling it.
You know, exactly.
And we would not have done it if that was the reason, you know?
Yeah, and it's not turning the Africa up or down. It's just what it is. It's just who we are. And we're very happy that we stayed the course, you know, because we've had even friends call us and say, hey, you might want to remove that because, you know, you may not sell as well or as much. But today, no complaint. People love it. People come in because of that, and people support it. And not just Africans. We have a huge percentage of our clients that are not African, that are people that would be in states that you would not go to.
Our audience is over 90% of our audience is non-African. And
that's interesting.
You know, yeah, we of course we want Africans to embrace this, and those that know of us embrace it, you know, wholeheartedly and support us. But this is exactly, this is proving the point that, you know, our products can do well outside of our own communities. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think this idea of changing people's view of Africa doesn't just apply to people that are non-African. It applies to Africans themselves.
As well, yeah. That could be a whole other conversation. More so, yeah. And I would agree. Yeah. I would agree. That's a whole conversation.
Yeah.
just quickly, we talked a lot about, or you mentioned as you talked about distribution, distributors. If we could quickly just tell people, how did you get your first distribution contract, if you will, the first buyer that said, yes, I'm going to put this on my shelf? The first major buyer, so let's say Whole Foods. What was the Whole Foods journey like?
Yeah, so Whole Foods is a retailer. We wouldn't consider them a distributor.
Yeah.
So there are companies outside of the retailers that would actually go and do all of that for you. But you know, it's part of it is really due to our past experiences. We are fearless when it comes to talking to people or selling. You know, we've gone through some really rough times. We've done all sorts of jobs. And so what we did is mainly just we started, you know, sort of all narrowing down which distributor we want to go after, which distributors sell our type of product. Because if you're selling a cold or a frozen product, and you go to someone who only does shelf stable stuff, that's the wrong distributor for you, because they cannot carry your product. So we narrowed it down to a few. And then the next step of it is very important. We call some of the people that they carried to see what kind of distributor they are, because there are some horrible distributors out there. Even the good ones are not so great. So you definitely don't want to be with a distributor who's not going to pay you. So that's the easy part. Now, then comes the hard part, convincing the ones you selected to carry you, essentially. So most distributors will not want to carry you if you have nothing, if you haven't done anything and you're not anywhere. So you cannot just have a really good product, and unless you have a really good connection and tons of marketing money, and just go to a distributor and say, hey, I want to put this product, can you distribute me? In our case, we did talk to them early enough and say, hey, we just wanted to know what it takes to be distributed by you guys. And we got some good information, and we even learned how distributors work a little bit by doing that. But eventually we went and built our own accounts, about 50 or 60. When we got to about 60 accounts, we knew it was time, and we were actively building. So it was nice to be able to come and say, hey, distribute us, and we have these additional 60 accounts that you can have and you can carry places that you might not be at this moment. But the way that happened was quite unique, because you were trying to talk to Whole Foods. Whole Foods wanted us to have a distributor before they would carry them. And we were talking to distributor, and they wanted us to have a major account before you could. So we told both we had it. And so one of the things was, this was genius, my brother Rahim did actually, was he would write to them and then ship the products immediately at the same time. So by the time they read their email, like the same day the product shows up,
they're drinking their ginger, and while they're reading the email.
Let me try this. And we were lucky that we had a very unique product. And some of them, a couple of them reached back out to us and said they were interested in talking. Cool. And that's how that happened, to be honest with you.
Cool. And I think that's an interesting distinction, because that's new to me. I mean, maybe those in this space know. I didn't understand the concept of distribute. I thought people usually work directly with a buyer at a retailer, but there's bulk distributors, it sounds like, that can get you into these accounts. Interesting. Good stuff. There's so much we could cover. We are running out of time, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So what's next for you guys? What's the next big thing? I mean, I think COVID has obviously had an impact on your business, probably changed what you were thinking about doing this year. But as you think about the rest of the year, 2021 and down the road, what's
yeah,
outlook?
I mean, we'll stay the course. I think we should be all right. We just want to see what happens after these elections, for you know, and then based on that, we will make the bigger decisions. But for now, we're just thankful that we're still around, we're still here. We've been doing much more business online with the shift of everything happening online, and We're still doing okay with Whole Foods. So one of the reasons why we're raising this round now is we think that this is actually a great time for us people in our position to take opportunities to take on these risks and challenges, because people that are in great position, they're too scared right now to act or to do anything.
Yeah.
And I think there are a lot of opportunities out there right now. If you look beyond this and you see, okay, how can I position myself or put myself in a position to excel in 2021 or in 2022? So once we raise this money, I think you may see a second or a third Jinjiang Cafe. You may see us a bit more on your phone, annoying you with ads. That's more or less it.
Cool.
Yeah, that's. And yeah, you know, we're fortunate enough that we're in the food business. So regardless of what happens to the economy at large, people still have to eat and drink. Mm-hmm. If we just have to figure out ways to make sure that we're top of mind when people are deciding how to figure out what to eat or drink, you know?
Cool. So before we
thing. We'll next month most likely, and by the end of the year anyways, we'll start having proper actual African food at the cafe.
Oh, awesome.
So you can come get some real jollof rice. All you Ghanaians and Nigerians.
We'll have to come and test to be sure it's proper jollof rice now.
They argue about it.
Yeah. So where can people find you online, social media, even, you know, if they want to support you, or even if they're based in New York, where can they find you in Harlem?
If you want to listen to the longest interview ever made on this podcast. You can find us at drinkjinjan.com, drinkjinjan, GINJAN.com. Our handle on social is at Jinjan Bros, GINJANBROS. And we actually respond to people ourselves most of the time. Please reach out if you have any questions.
Yeah.
Cool. And then, so we'll do this very quickly, more quickly than we do with most our rapid fire segments. So maybe we'll do one at a time so I don't know who wants to go first, but coffee or tea preference?
Tea right now.
Okay. I thought you would push your ginger latte, which I had and was phenomenal, by the way. Sorry, go ahead. You're going to say?
No, go ahead. It's rapid, so we got to go.
Morning person or night person?
Night.
This one is for the two of you. Your biggest pet peeve about your brother?
We need a new podcast for that.
Oh my God, I don't know.
Quick, first thing that comes to life.
My brother's too nice. I'm serious. he needs to be a little more cold-blooded. That's my pet peeve.
my brother over-educates people. But as I try to tell him, you cannot educate people beyond their understanding.
true. And then this last one, I guess for both of you together, I guess you've won, I guess Jinjan Brothers has won an award, or the mm-hmm. two of you individually, for your most notable achievement. What would this award be called?
This is not one we've gotten before. So
I just want people to think of me as a good guy.
The good guy I was. Nice guy.
Yeah. There's nothing that feels better right now than friends coming and saying, hey, because of you guys, we had the courage to go and get our own business going. And some of them have done it and are doing extremely well. So I don't know, some sort of inspirational award.
Inspirational award. Cool. Yeah. That's a great note to end on, because I think even though we've gone way over what we planned to do, I think your story is inspirational. I thank you so much for being open and candid about your journey, the specifics of it, because I think as we try to move forward in our own lanes in terms of what we want to do in this space, it's also mm-hmm. helpful to, you know, reach back, inform, support others that are also trying to make their path here, so that as a community, we sort of uplifting all of us together. As we, what do they say? Rising tides lift all boats.
Right.
So really appreciate you sharing and being as candid as you were. And we'll be looking forward to supporting you as you grow into a multi-billion dollar business.
Yes.
Thank
you so much.
Thank you so much for
extending us your platform. It means the world to us, you know, anyone that gives us a time of day, you know. So thank you for that. And for your audience too, for tuning in. If for those that are listening that may be looking to go into the food space, whether they're here or in Africa, especially in the traditional African food space, I encourage you. I mean, we're doing this for us. We believe in this. And I think there's a lot of room for growth in it. And one company or one team cannot do it all, right? So definitely do it. It's hard. Don't let all the scary stories we've just told you dissuade you. You know, definitely go for it and reach out to us if we can be helpful.
Yeah, it only takes two or three successes for people to, you know, drop their guard and realize that we are worth investing in. We're worth following. And so, the more of us, the merrier. So
do it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to Item 13, an African food podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe, rate, and review us on your favorite podcast app. To keep up to date, follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at Item 13 Podcast. Item 13 is powered by Simplecast. Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a non-profit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.